Since eyes are deaf and ears are blind to words and all their ways, I speak the sounds I write, hoping you see what somehow stays unheard and hear what never is quite clear at sight. With that as my pledge, I'd like to say three or four poems in another person and conclude with a few poems in my own. This first poem is called The Merchandiser's Song. Sell only the best for as much as you can, and make them believe it's a bargain from God. It takes as much effort to sell toothpicks as rubies, but think how the difference quintuples your profits, and then let the difference convince you it's worth it. I've done this for years, so I know what I'm saying. It's true that men look, but smart women shop, which means that they notice while men merely look. In choosing a car, a woman will favor a color that makes it the key to the deal, and the man has no choice but to buy it to please her. I've dealt with all kinds, so I know what I'm saying. With Arabs, you haggle. With Brits, you're exact. Don't deal with Chinese, or you're certain to lose. In business, a Frenchman is cool but correct. A Spaniard is calm unless he feels cheated. But if he feels cheated, you better leave town. I've traveled a lot, so I know what I'm saying. Don't brag of your gains or you'll gain the wrong friends. If you lose, you'd be wise not to mention your losses. Gripe, and you'll find you'll bore your defenders and gladden all those who are happy you flopped. Look up when you're down, look down when you're up. I've won and I've lost, so I know what I'm saying. If men have to choose for today or tomorrow, they'll choose for today, and tomorrow can wait, which means that you sell them what tempts them right now, before they can think of a reason to say they would if they could, or thanks, but no thanks. I've learned how men think, so I know what I'm saying. Selling yourself is a game without mercy. If nobody buys, you're equal to zero. The name of the game is how much you are worth. If you make a million, you're worth what you've made. If you take in nothing, you're not worth a thing. I've sold my whole life, so I know what I'm saying. You don't have to applaud. This poem is a continuation. Before that, though, I'd like to do what others have done. I'd like to remember Jimmy for what he's created. And also, she'll be embarrassed when I say this, Tito Capobianco, who is a magnificent presence in this city, both a visionary man, talented man, and a completely charming man. This poem is a continuation in the spirit of the Merchandiser's Song. It's called The Ballad of the Jolly Broker. Nothing was surer amid all the furor than watching a stock that I picked on a hunch make rich men of paupers and paupers of fools, and all in the pinch that it took to eat lunch. My betting and cheering took real engineering. I guessed and I gauged and I bet and I prayed, from the dawn of the bull to the dusk of the bear, where fortunes were waiting and fortunes were made. The law of percents is a law that resents whenever its buyouts are less than a steal. Its language is money, and money is lethal, and nothing makes sense but the luck of the deal. You have to like poker to be a good broker. You have to take chances and hope for the best. Buy cheap and sell dear is the law of the market, and woe unto those who forget or protest. Like any good broker, I like to play poker. But poker's a game where all that you got is a lure of the cards and the stack of the chips and the dice of the deal and the pay of the pot. So I took all my winnings, that some called my sinnings, and lived like a king where the snow never fell. I drank all my juices and swallowed my pills and bet on the races. And down came hell. It cost me my wife in the prime of my life. It made me content with much less than the best. I worked for the day when I never would work. And the money was sure. And the honey was rest. If you'd rather be healthy than feeble and wealthy, if you'd rather be happy than wed to a bed, then think of a man with a millionaire's tan who died half a lifetime before he was dead. That this poem creates mixed feelings in me. It's called The Ballad of the Broken Tackle. I say this as somebody who was raised, I played football, I coached it in the service. I have to admit now, it's a bad game. It's a fascist game. Baseball audiences are in decline all over the country. You know that. Not because of winning or losing, they're just in decline. And yet, you look at baseball, the hardest thing in all sports is to hit a thrown ball with a 32 or 34 ounce bat thrown by somebody who doesn't want you to hit it. Even the best hitter, Ted Williams, who batted 403, knew that he failed 6 out of 10 times. So the absurdity of the game is so obvious. But the beauty of it is that it spurns time. Unlike football, hockey, basketball, all the rest, baseball is not governed by the clock at all. The defense has the ball. And the game only begins when they're ready to throw it and you're ready to hit it. There's no surprise. In fact, one of the ironies of baseball is that they run the bases counterclockwise. I want to pass on some statistics to you. It's a known fact in professional football, which is not going to die because the money is too heavy. But but these are true statistics. The percentage of those who retire from professional football with permanent injuries to the neck or to the knee, 100%. 100%. I watched an interview with Mike Ditka and Brett Favre. And at the end of the interview, they asked, knowing what you now know about the injuries I just cited, plus concussions, which is only of recent note, they asked both of them, Mike Ditka, Brett Favre, if you had a son, would you let him play football? They both answered emphatically, no. No. This poem is dedicated to them. It's called The Ballad of the Broken Tackle. If your squat is a rock, and you know how to block, and the backs that you block for are shifty, you can dream of a life with a Hollywood wife and a ranch you'll own outright at 50. But the jackpots of fame and your love of the game never match what you learned as a player. You crouch in the dirt, and you play when you're hurt. And you wake up one day, and you're grayer. Though nobody sees when you're gone on the knees, so you flinch when you're running or bending. You feel in your heart that you're coming apart, and you know when you're reaching the ending. Jim Otto would glow with a big double O on the jerseys he wore in his glory. Today, he needs care, and he's wheeled in a chair. And that's just one man in his story. Look hard at the rest of the worst and the best, and notice how much they're reliant on braces and canes and some pills for their pains that have left them subdued but defiant. The owners ate well while you sweated like hell to give the whole city a reason to light up the sky like the 4th of July at the end of your winningest season. Looking back, you can see it's no bonus to be number one in a league of achievers. It just rouses the loud and the stadium crowd and the rest of the paying believers. Overlooking the noise, it's a game meant for boys. At its best, it's no more than a pastime. But why were there tears despite all the cheers when you limped off the field for the last time? We did a program a few years ago, and Andy Russell read that poem. You remember Andy Russell? People don't know it, but Andy Russell majored in English. And when he read that poem, I said to him, I said, "You look kind of downcast." He said, "It resonates with me. It resonates with me." This next poem is for a friend of mine who served in Vietnam, a prolonged tragedy, just as Iraq is a prolonged tragedy. And he went back, and he's gone back several times and created an orphanage there. He's from Pittsburgh, by the way. I'm not going to mention his name because it'll embarrass him, but an amazing individual. This poem is called The Ballad of a Returnee. He knew he was older and taller. He knew that the towns were the same. What made them seem suddenly smaller? What made him feel somehow to blame for all that was done to a village to save a surrounded platoon? The huts were just booty to pillage on a hillscape as spare as the moon. A man with one leg saw him walking and offered him tea on a mat. They spent the whole afternoon talking while his wife cooked the head of a cat. It wasn't his squad, it remembered. It wasn't the sergeant at Way who found his lieutenant dismembered and buried him there where he lay. What troubled him most were the places that once were just places to fight. He thought of the night fighters' faces all blackened to blend with the night. The whores in their teens were forgotten, and gone were their overnight dates, and grown were the idly begotten, whose fathers were back in the States. He never regretted returning. At least it had lessened his dread. But the price that it took for the learning was 58,000 dead. He walked all alone by the water. He sat all alone by the shore, like a man making peace with the slaughter. But the price for this peace was war. This poem is about Pittsburgh. It's called Signs of Life in a Sundown City. We number less than half of what we were 6 decades back. The young look elsewhere for their lives. The old grow older and die. Mansions of a long dead gentry calcify like skulls. Museums lease from millionaires what artists painted while they starved. Painted while they starved. The currency uptown is guns and drugs, and murderers grow younger by the day. Regardless, the trees parade in place at permanent attention. Simply by happening, each day proclaims itself unique and unrepeatable, and 2 defiant rivers fork and fuse into a third that flows into a fourth that steers in silence to the sea that stayed the same since Genesis. This poem is called One-Liners or Less. What made Elizabeth say, "I'm not attractive to men"? Or Patty say, "My brother is so good, he's boring"? Or Dolores in her 80s say, "I want more birthdays, but I don't want to celebrate them"? Or Barbara, once divorced, admit, "The world is ruled by couples." Such frankness in some women makes the truth less fearsome if admitted when faced. And there's a lighter side as well. Watching his wife peruse the mail in her underwear, he said, "Suppose a strange man walked in here." Without pausing to look up, she said, "You are a strange man." When the party crasher insulted the French hostess by saying, "Your meal was fit for a pig," she smiled, a Parisian smile, and said, "So glad you felt at home." But Marilyn Monroe outdid them all. Asked if she had something on when Joe DiMaggio proposed, she said with grave innocence, "The radio." The shorter the phrase, the keener the wit. The keener the wit, the surer the touch. The surer the touch, the purer the art that knows when one word more would be a word too much. This poem, I'm only going to say a couple more poems, then I'll quit. This poem, I'm sitting on the porch of our home, and it suddenly hit me that in a finite number of years, somebody else will be living here. The more I thought about that, the more furious I got. So I wrote this poem to get it out of my system. It's called To Whom It Will Concern. I know that someday you or somebody just like you will live here. You'll have a key, my key. You'll scrap the rugs, paint all the rooms in different colors, and change my study to a storage room. I feel already violated and upset. This place is more than real estate to me. My wife and I worked hard to make it ours. Her tulips, lilacs, mums, and rhododendrons stop whoever's passing by. I've mown the lawn myself and keep it free of weeds. What's that to you? You'll cut the maple down that all the lilacs fester, and changed my study to a packed storage room. I know we've never met, and never will, but I've had my fill of you. Who asked you here? Who cares if you pay twice the purchase price or not? I'll tell you what I've said before. I'm staying where I am. So take your bucks and scram. I'll say, these two poems and then I'll finish. I say these poems, and I've never said this in public. These are the only two poems I've ever written that I've ever not changed a word. With almost every other one, I've changed something. This first poem is called Home of the Sailors, and it deals with a theme that becomes more intense with me as I grow older, and that is that the oldest themes in literature and in culture are themes about home. Men go to war and they come home, you know. Homer wrote about Odysseus, who was gone 10 years of war and 10 years of coming home, but all he wanted to do was come home. You find it in Enoch Arden in our own literature. People get up in the morning, they go to work, and they come home. They go overseas on a vacation, and they can't wait to get back to their own country and their own city and their own home. And some people, and most religions, believe that life is a journey home. They give it different definitions, but there's something in us that's so deep that it can't deny that. There's something in us that is so deep, the sense of home, that it can't ever be repealed. I mean, we'll die with that on our lips. Like those who sail away and then come back, we keep returning to a port we've never left. A life we used to live awaits us there. So much seems differently the same, and yet, what is the present but a future that the past made possible? There is no older story. And what are we but random pilgrims stopped in progress to remember? If now seems more like then, why care? As long as home means where we most belong, for just that long, were there. And a final poem, which I have to admit is a favorite of mine. They say you shouldn't say that, you know, like if you have a big family, you don't say who's your favorite child. It's called And the Time Is. And I want to thank you for coming. We've come to the point of decision. And the hands of the clock say, be careful. We've learned from the past that our choices are one or the other or neither. And the hands of the clock say, be careful. We've readied ourselves for the challenge of weighing the odds and the chances of what will result from our choices. And the hands of the clock say, be hopeful. We're not what we were when we started, and the hands of the clock say, it's over. Our yesterdays lengthen like shadows that fade when we no longer cast them. And the hands of the clock say, it's over. Despite what it brings to surprise us, we treasure each day in its passing, though we know that we pass as it passes. And the hands of the clock say, discover. We sit on the porch every evening, and the hands of the clock say, be watchful. We study the leaves in their turning from green to vermilion to purple, and the hands of the clock say, be watchful. While we stare at the sky and its vastness and name every star in the distance, we dwindle to scale in the balance. in the hands of the clock say, be grateful. The dead come to life in our dreaming, and the hands of the clock say, remember. The words of a prophet keep haunting the ones who ignored him when living, and the hands of the clock say, remember. The world that we think is around us is neither before nor behind us, but always within us, within us. And the hands of the clock say, forever. Thank you very much.